Espionage is as old as human history itself. The clandestine watching of others and reporting on their actions has caused battles to be won and lost, as well as affected all types of relationships. When you think about it, we probably don't even know about history's best spies, since they were never caught or exposed. But in this lecture, let's look at a few of the more notorious cases of espionage over the last 100 years. World War II was a particularly active time for some fairly sophisticated spying. And the most successful agents, of course, were those with genuine connections to more than one country. William Siebold, born in 1899 in Mülheim, had served the Imperial German Army during World War I, but moved to the United States a couple years after the war's end. By 1936, he was a naturalized U.S. citizen. Siebold worked as an engineer in various industrial plants, including some involved in aircraft manufacturing. In 1939, during a trip to Germany to visit his sick mother, a high-ranking member of the German Secret Service approached Siebold to persuade him to spy on America. Fearing danger to his family still living in Germany and recognizing the Germans knew about an early arrest he hadn't reported during his U.S. citizenship application, Siebold reluctantly agreed. Under German guidance, Siebold received training in both radio communications and microphotography and was given instructions for returning to the U.S. But while still in Germany, Siebold's passport was stolen, forcing him to make a trip to the American consulate in Cologne, where he revealed his recent encounter with the Gestapo. Siebold told U.S. officials of the Nazis' plans for him, but said he wanted to turn the tables and work with the Federal Bureau of Investigation as a double agent against Germany. He told the consulate the Nazis had instructed him to return to the U.S. and serve as an intermediary between Germany and other German spies in America. He was to play the role of Harry Sawyer, diesel engineering consultant. The Germans told Siebold he was to receive encoded messages from the Nazis and likewise respond to them in code. In February of 1940, Siebold did return to New York, and within a 16-month period, using a Long Island shortwave radio transmitter, not Siebold, but the FBI posing as German spy Harry Sawyer, sent over 300 phony messages to the Nazis and received over 200 messages from them in return. The FBI also outfitted Siebold with an office in Manhattan, where he could meet with other German spies while collecting the forensic evidence that would incriminate them. The FBI bugged the office with hidden microphones and used two-way mirrors to film Siebold's encounters with German agents. Among Siebold's German spy contacts was ringleader Frederick Duquesne. He was born in South Africa, but became a U.S. citizen in 1913. Duquesne particularly hated the British after the Boer Wars killed several in his family, and as a result had spied for Germany during both World War I and II. The Duquesne World War II spy ring consisted of 30 men and 3 women, one of whom was Duquesne's Arkansas-born girlfriend. Nearly all the male spies were originally from Germany, and most had become naturalized U.S. citizens. At the point Siebold met Duquesne, the purpose of the Duquesne spy network was to collect information about the United States, including any military and industrial weaknesses that could be exploited should America enter World War II, which happened, of course, after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. Those in the Duquesne spy ring worked in a variety of jobs, including some low-key positions like transatlantic ship's barber, ship's butcher, ship painter, truck driver, and the owner of a restaurant where covert meetings were held. But other Duquesne spies held high-level technical jobs, including one employed by Carl L. Norden Incorporated, manufacturer of the Norden bomb sight, an aircraft device that ensures bombing accuracy, as well as other highly confidential materials essential to U.S. national defense. The United States Army Air Forces considered the Norden equipment so top secret that American bombardiers were required to take an oath, stating they would defend its secrecy with their own life if needed. Anyway, the Germans set up a meeting between Siebold as Harry Sawyer and Duquesne, during which Duquesne told Siebold about ways German agents could set fire to American industrial plants. Duquesne also shared plans he'd stolen from the DuPont Corporation in Delaware that illustrated the new atomic bomb being developed by the U.S. Another Duquesne spy, Paul Banty, provided Siebel with detonation caps and dynamite he assumed would be used to carry out an attack. Siebel was able to relay all this German information and forensic evidence into U.S. hands. Now, based on the Siebold sting operation, on June 29, 1941, in a massive roundup, 93 U.S. special agents captured 30 members of the Duquesne spy ring. The other three were aboard ships, but were arrested at their next ports of call. 19 pled guilty to espionage, but the other 14 entered pleas of not guilty and were brought to trial in federal district court in September of 1941. On December 13, 1941, less than a week after Pearl Harbor was attacked, the jury found all of them guilty. In January of 1942, all 33 members of the Duquesne espionage ring were sentenced to serve a total of over 300 years in prison. Siebel disappeared after the trial, presumably into a witness protection program. He's thought to have died in California in 1970. A key German intelligence leader later said that Siebel's activity dealt what amounted to a death blow to German spy efforts in the United States. The FBI's first director, J. Edgar Hoover, called the incident the greatest spy roundup in the history of the United States. It remains that to this day. Another infamous spy of World War II was a woman born Velvely Blücher in 1893 in Sacramento, California. After attending Stanford University, Velvely worked at an agricultural brokerage firm in San Francisco for Lee Dickinson, the man she would later marry. Her husband's company had many Japanese and Japanese-American clients, so as a result, Mrs. Dickinson became fascinated with Japanese culture. The couple became quite the socialites. Mrs. Dickinson, dressed in a kimono, attended functions at the Japanese consulate in San Francisco, and later in New York City, where the couple moved in 1937, after the Great Depression caused their California company to fail. By that time, Mr. Dickinson's health was failing as well. In New York, the couple opened a doll shop, first in their home and later at a storefront they leased on Madison Avenue. Velvely ran the shop, which catered not only to New Yorkers, but other wealthy U.S. and foreign nationals who collected rare and antique dolls. But the Dickinson shop was barely staying afloat, often requiring loans to keep it in business. Mysteriously, though, the couple's fortune turned around after the United States entered World War II. Less than 2 months after the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor, wartime censors intercepted a letter that had been sent to Buenos Aires, but was being returned to the U.S. marked address unknown. The letter had been sent to a woman named Inez Molinari, who no longer lived at that address and was actually named Inez Molinari. The letter's return address was Portland, Oregon, and the alleged sender's name was Sarah Gellert. The censor's problem with the correspondence related to a cryptic message about three, quote, old English dolls that had been left at a, quote, doll hospital. FBI codebreakers figured out the dolls were references to U.S. warships, and the doll hospital was code for a shipyard. When questioned, Gellert says she didn't send the letter and she had no idea who did. Over the next several months, mail censors sent the FBI four more similar letters they discovered. Each had been addressed to Buenos Aires in the misspelled name of Inez Molinari, and each had been returned to a different U.S. sender as undeliverable. Each letter mentioned dolls and contained bits of personal information about the supposed sender, who denied writing the letter or knowing anything about Molinari. More curiously, the alleged senders told the FBI the personal information about them in the letters was correct, and the signatures even kind of resembled their own handwriting, but they hadn't sent the letters. Neither did the U.S. postmarks of all the letters match the cities provided in the return addresses. One of the letters mentioned a doll dressed in a grass hula skirt being repaired in Seattle, while another talked about a lovely Siamese temple dancer damaged by a tear in its middle, but was being fixed. Cryptographers easily figured out that the doll with the hula skirt referred to a ship that had recently been moved from Hawaii to Seattle, and that the Siamese doll was really a damaged aircraft carrier under repair. In addition to doll references, the letters contained other curious entries, like a letter allegedly sent from not far outside my hometown of Cincinnati, Ohio. It mentioned a Mr. Shaw who was said to have destroyed a letter because he was ill and was currently having his damaged car repaired, but would soon be back at work. The Cincinnati FBI office sent this to cryptographers, who determined the message was about the USS Shaw, a destroyer that had been hit by the Japanese but was being repaired. All these letters to Argentina could ultimately be decoded as veiled references to the status and location of U.S. Navy ships, especially those that had been damaged at Pearl Harbor. When trying to connect the information about the dolls, the Japanese and the unsuspecting U.S. citizens, all of those whose names and addresses had been hijacked, the FBI came up with one single commonality. All victims of this scam had done business with Velvalee Dickinson's New York doll shop. In fact, at one time, each had written to Velvalee from their home addresses, and as a result, had unknowingly provided her with samples of their signature, as well as the personal details about themselves that ended up in the letters. An FBI document examiner determined that although the signatures on the letters were similar to each of the alleged sender's actual handwriting, all did show standard characteristics of forgery, like inconsistencies in letter formation and a lack of natural flow. The letters themselves were typed, and the keystroke hammers of old-style typewriters become increasingly unique over time due to wear. Investigators could tell that 5 different typewriters had been used to formulate the letters. One of the alleged senders was able to provide the FBI with a typed letter previously sent to her by Velvalee Dickinson. The forensic examiner could tell it had been created using the same typewriter as one of the letters addressed to Buenos Aires. The 5 letters were all postmarked between January and June of 1942, and from a variety of U.S. cities. 4 on the West Coast, 1 from New York, so the FBI next focused on those places. They found hotel records establishing that the Dickinsons had been in each of those cities around the dates the letters were mailed. Investigators examined typewriters available to guests in those hotels and could match the other 4 forged letters to hotel typewriters. Digging into Mrs. Dickinson's background, the FBI found that her contacts included a variety of Japanese organizations and spanned San Francisco, New York, Washington, D.C., dating back to the early 1930s. They further learned the Dickinsons had regularly entertained Japanese officials in their San Francisco home. Apparently, none of Velvalee's Japanese contacts had notified her that the Buenos Aires woman to whom she'd been sending the coded messages had moved. While Inez Molinari had lived at that address at one time and was married to a man who did business with the Japanese, when she was found and questioned, she claimed to know nothing about the letters the code breakers had intercepted. She had no connection with the Dickinsons and didn't even collect dolls. And why did Velvalee Dickinson choose those third parties whose return addresses she fraudulently used? The best the FBI could figure, some of those people were clients with whom the Dickinsons had a negative business interaction, like a long-standing unpaid balance with the doll shop. Velvalee probably would have done better to use the addresses of complete strangers who may not have been so easily traced back to her. Now, the FBI watched the Dickinsons for some time, hoping to gain more information about a possible spy ring to which they belonged. But after her husband died of heart disease in March of 1943, they decided to close in on Velvalee. On January 21, 1944, 2 agents followed as the petite 50-year-old woman, conservatively dressed as usual, walked into her bank. When she opened her safe deposit box, the men grabbed Velvalee and put her under arrest. Although she struggled with the agents, she was barely 5 feet tall and weighed only about 100 pounds, so obviously was no match. The agents confiscated the bank box, finding cash and checks totaling nearly $16,000, about 10,000 of which was in $100 bills. Now, that was quite a sum of money at that time and prompted a lot of explaining for a woman whose doll shop had been known to have a cash flow problem. Velva Lee told the FBI agents she had found the money under her husband's mattress after his death, but she had no idea where he'd gotten it. Agents were able to trace the serial numbers of some of the bills back to Japanese naval inspectors' offices in New York. At that point, Velva Lee admitted her husband had been spying for the Japanese. She stated a man connected to the Japanese Navy had paid her husband $25,000 in $100 bills to send coded information to the Buenos Aires address. But as part of the investigation, agents questioned Mr. Dickinson's physician, who said the man had been so mentally incapacitated during the time in question, there was no way he could have carried out the plot. Unable to confidently convict Velva Lee with espionage, she was charged with violation of wartime censorship laws, which prohibited U.S. citizens from passing confidential information to foreign entities. While in jail, pending trial, they pressed Velva Lee not only to admit her guilt, but also provide counterintelligence about Japanese activities, since World War II was still in progress. Now, knowing the FBI would continue to investigate and that espionage could carry the death penalty, Velva Lee admitted that she herself had written the letters. She told investigators she and her husband would travel between the east and west coasts of the U.S. using their doll business as a cover. On these visits, they would watch the shipyards to gain information. They'd hang around near the docks, talking to unsuspecting locals about the repair progress and get other details. In August of 1944, Velva Lee Dickinson was convicted of evading the censorship laws. She was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. She earned an early release in 1951 and then disappeared from public view in the mid-1950s. No one apparently knows how, where, or when she died. One source I consulted points out an interesting fact, that for all the paranoia around Japanese Americans that led to the internment camps, in which so many people were held, the only spy ever known to hand over U.S. military secrets after the attacks on Pearl Harbor was little old Velva Lee Dickinson. Here's a comparison I find interesting. Today, people are debating privacy issues related to the U.S. government's monitoring of American phone and email communications with foreigners. During World War II, though, people seemed to take for granted these types of surveillance efforts, which at least in the Velva Lee Dickinson case clearly did net important intelligence about spies in our midst. When considering famous spies, especially female wartime agents, the name Mata Hari is likely to come up. She was born in the Netherlands in August of 1876 as Margaretha Zella, the only daughter of a wealthy businessman who eventually went bankrupt. After her mother's death, Margaretha's search for a better life caused her to answer a Dutch military officer's newspaper ad soliciting a wife. A few months later, in 1895, at age 18, she became Mrs. Rudolph MacLeod, wife of an army captain stationed in Indonesia, at that time known as the Dutch East Indies. MacLeod was 20 years older than Margaretha and allegedly abusive to her. Their unhappy marriage led to two children, but the couple's son died at age 2, supposedly from treatment for congenital syphilis the children's father passed to Margaretha before she gave birth. It was while living on the island of Java in the Dutch East Indies that Margaretha is said to have become enamored with two things that would end up directing the rest of her life: Indonesian dance and men in uniform. In 1902, the couple returned to the Netherlands. They separated and began a custody battle for their young daughter. When her husband threatened to stop supporting the child, Margaretha gave over custody and moved to Paris to start a new life. Beautiful and 5'10" tall, Margaretha had dark hair, dark eyes, and an olive complexion, perhaps related either to the days of Spanish domination over what's now the Netherlands, or the 17th and 18th century colonialism of the Dutch East India Company, centered in what's now Jakarta. Margaretha capitalized on her exotic looks and knowledge of Indonesian dance. She reinvented herself as Mata Hari, which means, quote, the eye of the day. In other words, the sun. She marketed herself as a Hindu princess from the Far East and quickly became a very successful exotic dancer. Mata Hari's veil dances were notoriously unusual for the day because they would include taking off all of her clothing except for a jeweled bra she apparently refused to remove, being self-conscious of a small bust. In great demand throughout Western Europe, Mata Hari began to have both short and long-term relationships with numerous rich and powerful men, including military officers and politicians. She was always able to find men to spend money on her, and many considered her little more than a high-paid prostitute, known in those days as a courtesan. In 1914, Mata Hari agreed to a 6-month contract in Berlin, but when World War I broke out in August of that year, the job fell through, and at nearly 40 years old, she returned to the Netherlands. A man from the German consulate in Holland contacted the well-connected Mata Hari to tell her the Germans were recruiting wartime spies. She was given the code name H21 and a cash payment, but apparently did little to nothing to earn the money, except resume her European travels. Returning to Paris, Mata Hari allegedly met the love of her life, a Russian military officer named Vladimir Maslov, who was only 21, nearly 2 decades younger than the former dancer. After returning to the front, Vladimir was injured and taken to a hospital in northeastern France. Because the hospital was within the war zone, civilians had to get permission to travel there. And while Mata Hari was applying for a permit, she met Georges Ledoux, the captain of the French counterintelligence. Even though she had already accepted German espionage money, Mata Hari swore to Ledoux that, like her Dutch homeland, she was neutral, and due to her many years in Paris, was really a French sympathizer. Ledoux asked if she would spy on the Germans for the French, and Mata Hari agreed to seduce a German officer to obtain information for Ledoux. All this, mind you, supposedly to get a pass to visit her young Russian lover. Some say the mission backfired on her, and that the French were actually setting her up so they could later claim she was passing French secrets to the Germans. Due to her frequent European travels, her liaisons with men of all nationalities, and the fact that she could speak French, English, Italian, and some German, in addition to her native Dutch, Mata Hari was constantly watched by all manner of military intelligence agencies. In 1916, Scotland Yard detained her for questioning, but couldn't pin anything on her. She allegedly told them she was working for the French intelligence, but was suspected of being a double agent for the Germans. In January of 1917, the French intercepted a radio message from the German military that credited Mata Hari, their agent H21, with transferring information to them. Many now believe the German military may have actually set the former dancer up so the French would no longer trust her. In February of 1917, Mata Hari was arrested in Paris and put on trial. But neither the French nor the British could bring forth any definitive forensic evidence or testimony against her. Her defense attorney, a former lover, was not even allowed to cross-examine the prosecution's witnesses. Despite her claims that her international liaisons were due to nothing more than her infamous exotic dancing, Mata Hari was found guilty after only 45 minutes of deliberation. She was executed by a French firing squad in October of 1917. Today, for all the infamy that's been associated with her name, sources disagree on whether Mata Hari actually ever spied for anybody, insinuating her actions were merely those of an attention-seeking, romantic gold digger. Our last story is more recent and takes us to the United States. Throughout the late 1980s, the Federal Bureau of Investigation began to recognize there was a dangerous double agent in their midst who was posing a threat to national security. The Soviets' own security and intelligence agency, at that time the KGB, was increasingly in possession of highly classified information that could only be coming from one or more of the FBI's own agents. When the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics disbanded in 1991, the KGB's successor became known as the SVR, the New Russian Foreign Intelligence Service. For a while after the transition, it looked as though the leaks had stopped, or at least had slowed considerably. But soon, the double agent appeared to be at it again. By the late 1990s, forensic profilers within the Bureau were focusing on one particular guy, who both the FBI and the Central Intelligence Agency began to investigate. They secretly entered the agent's home, searched his property, bugged his phone, and began round-the-clock surveillance. After 2 years, however, which eventually included direct questioning of the suspect and his entire family, the FBI and CIA realized they had been watching the wrong man. The Bureau's next decision was to try and find a Russian who would be willing to give up the name of the traitor in exchange for money. They settled on a former KGB operative who said that while he didn't know the double agent's name, he knew where to find it. The man went to Russia's SVR headquarters and actually stole files he knew were related to the American mole. He informed the FBI the materials included correspondence between their double agent and the KGB between the years 1985 and 1991. The Russian agreed to surrender the files in exchange for the FBI's promise of $7 million, along with safe passage to the United States and new identities for his entire family. To this day, that Russian's name remains classified. In November of 2000, the FBI obtained the package. And while it didn't contain the name of the double agent, it included documents, computer disks, and an audio tape. The recording was of a July 21, 1986 conversation between the FBI mole and a KGB agent. Upon listening to the tape, investigators thought they recognized the voice as Agent Robert Hansen, one of the Bureau's wiretapping, surveillance, and computer experts, who had worked for the FBI for nearly 25 years in their Washington, D.C. and New York offices. The materials also included a plastic bag, and despite over a decade, the FBI's forensic unit was able to lift two fingerprints off it. They both belonged to Hansen. Although the FBI was sure they had their man, they had to catch him in the act. Interestingly, to do so, in December of 2000, they promoted him to a new position and gave him an assistant, who was, of course, assigned to watch Hansen's every move at work. His assistant was able to download Hansen's palm device, you know, those precursors to smartphones, and he recovered incriminating encrypted data. Agents also searched Hansen's car while it was parked in the FBI office garage and found white adhesive tape and white chalk in the glove compartment. In the trunk, they discovered 7 classified documents Hansen had downloaded, which they assumed he planned to pass to the Russians. In Hansen's suburban D.C. neighborhood, the FBI even purchased the house across the street and began 24-hour surveillance. On several occasions in December of 2000, agents observed Hansen driving slowly past a local recreational spot called Foxstone Park. By January of 2001, he was driving past the same place in the park almost every night. They realized he was looking for a sign from the Russians that they were ready for his next drop. On Sunday, February 18, 2001, agents stationed in the park watch Hansen exit his car and place a piece of white tape on a park sign. Next, he walked off into the woods carrying a package and taped it underneath a wooden footbridge. At that point, 10 FBI agents came at him from all angles and put him under arrest. Hansen's reply was, "What took you so long?" Since 1985, using the name Ramon Garcia, and similar drop-style transfers, Hansen had passed thousands of pages of documents to intelligence officers of the Soviet KGB and later the Russian SVR, apparently only once meeting any of his contacts face-to-face. He refused Russian offers of overseas travel, instead making them come to the drop sites that he arranged. Hansen regularly monitored FBI communications to make sure no one suspected him, and was apparently aware of the Bureau's suspicions near the end. During the mid-80s, Hansen also had named 3 Soviets who had been betraying their country as U.S. double agents. Within 3 years of being exposed, 2 of those men had been executed, and the 3rd wound up in a Soviet prison. In fact, after the FBI learned their Russian operatives had been exposed, Hansen himself was the man they tasked with finding out who did it. So he was, in essence, at that point, looking for himself. Hansen's expertise in computer forensics gave him not only the know-how to get the information, but also enabled him to avoid detection. His motive was apparently purely financial. Over the two decades Hansen was a double agent, he received nearly $1.5 million in cash and diamonds from the Russians, but was careful to never display any indications he was making more money than a typical agent. On July 6, 2001, 25 years after taking an oath to, quote, support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, Hansen pled guilty to espionage and was later sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole.